You guys see Gilbert Gottfried at the Joan Rivers roast? He said Joan Rivers is so old that her tits are labeled whites only in colors.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Yours, where thinking is free. Today's episode brought to you by The Big Bang.
Boom.
Sitting next to me is my co-host and producer, Heather Henderson.
Hi, everybody.
You know Heather from the Facebooks, on the inner tubes, and from our other award-winning podcast, Ardent Atheist. You can find links to our guest website, join our Twitter and Facebook feeds, subscribe to our premium 90-minute full-length episodes, and our email at skepticallyyours.net.
If you'd like to take part in the live chat moderated by nobody right now...
Yeah, he's not there.
Go to skepticallyyours.net/live and chat us up right now, if it's open. If it is, I have
is
no
it
idea.
Open? I don't know that we
opened
that.
I don't think it's open.
And please go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcast for free, and write a review. Help us get in the top 10. You may also go to skepticallyyours.net/premium and subscribe to our premium ad-free content for a measly $10 per year.
Subscribe now or I will kill you.
Can't threaten people like that.
Why not?
Killing is immoral.
So it's not subscribing.
No, it's not.
You don't really want to stay alive, do you?
Stop that!
If you're a listener who's ever been duped by anything that's been debunked on Snopes, welcome. Your ordeal is over.
We're coming to you live from TAM 2013 from the BJ Suite in rainy Las Vegas, Nevada.
It's rainy?
It was. In the suite tonight, we have Dave Silverman.
Hello, hello.
And Todd Robbins.
It's an honor.
Honor.
Yeah, honor.
You know these gentlemen from the World of Reason.
That's exactly right.
Reason.
I think they're both reasonable people.
I don't know about this guy over here.
He's
illusion.
Pretty ardent.
It's an illusion.
It is an illusion. I'm going to ask you to get close to that mic for
all
me.
All right, fine.
Todd. Now, it's weird for an editor to meet Todd Robbins after spending a year working on a project with you in it as the star.
I told him he's much taller in real life.
He's much taller in real life?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, the screen's really tiny. One day we'll have life-size screens we get to edit on.
That would be funky.
Then you'll know that Todd Robbins is a monster.
I am.
He is a freak of fucking nature.
But Penn Jillette can still eat his breakfast off the top of my head.
Wow.
Yes, true.
Yes, it's true.
Wow, that's a picture I can't masturbate to anymore.
Good night, folks.
Todd, you were fantastic in Play Dead.
I really was.
Yes, you were.
You really were.
God damn it.
It's scary how it's an illusion.
I know, right?
it was a fun thing to do. And outside of the fact that Teller cut out all my jokes from the goddamn film.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there were transitions that needed to be done, and I just shut up. And
Let's see what Teller has to say on the matter. Teller. Oh.
Exactly.
Emery.
But I make fun of Teller because he's not here.
Uh-huh.
Right.
That's a smart move.
Emery, why don't you describe what Play Dead is for
a
the
A lot
listeners.
Of people, if you're listening to our show and you don't know what Play Dead is, fuck you.
That's
Play
right.
Dead is
he says that with love, of course.
Yes, I do. Play Dead is a really, really amazing show. It's written by Todd and Teller.
Yeah. Sometimes Todd versus Teller.
Right. That's how all writing collaborations go.
Mm-hmm.
Teller put a lot of magic in this show, first of all, which I thought was just fantastic.
Well, thank you.
It's amazing.
Yeah, we started, unlike almost any magic show that you... You see where they find a trick that they like and then figure out a way of doing it in some sort of presentation, or with many of the shows here in Vegas, no presentation.
Right.
we kind of went the other way around. This all started as a project I did a number of years ago. I did a seance show in the New York International Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And it was called Dark Deceptions, and it was all about seances and spiritualist fraud.
It exposed the frauds?
And, yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Good.
And it was basically, it started off with a little prologue that was very much like Henry V, for a Muse of Fire. And it basically said, what you're going to see tonight is fake, it's always been fake, and tonight will be no different. So therefore, it can be a lot of fun and can be a powerful experience if you look at all this through the eyes of a believer.
Mm.
And if you'll play the role of the believer, I'll play the role of the reverend, and I will... From here on in, we will go straight forward, and I will be the reverend of a spiritualist church, and we will have a seance. And it was fine, except that people have an image of a seance, very Hollywood, people sitting around a table, and I was kind of embracing more of a spiritualist church for, because I want to use a, I don't want to do it for more than 12 people at a time,
right?
And make some money at it. And one day I will make some money at this. And I hope. So the end result was that we, I did the show and it was all right. And then I retooled and we did it at the Two River Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey. And it was okay, but it still wasn't firing on all the cylinders. And there was a producer approached me about doing it in New York and said, you need a director. And I said, yeah, I do. Is there anyone you're interested in? And we played around with a couple of different people, New York directors, and they were all like, well, you're doing a magic show.
Oh.
And I do theater.
Mm-hmm.
I do plays that cure cancer. You understand?
Yeah.
When I mount a Shakespearean production, it solves world hunger. That is what my art does, and you're doing a magic show.
Mm-hmm.
And so the good news is the producer is the same guy behind Stomp. That's been going for like 25 years. And so he's been confronted with the snobbery of performance versus theater.
Yeah.
And he has made millions off of performance. So he doesn't care about all that. And he wanted to make it a legitimate show that people could respect. But at the same time, he wanted it to be fun and a ticket that people would buy. So I called Teller and said, I've got this thing. Would you like to direct it? And he went, yeah.
And you've known Teller for years?
Yeah, we met in prison. no, I met them, I saw Asparagus Valley Cultural Society in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And then met them when they were playing off-Broadway in the late 80s.
Yeah.
When they were naked and covered with blood?
No, before that. Well, I mean, they were naked, but not on stage at that point.
Yeah. He met them before the salad years.
Yeah, exactly. And introduced by Jamie and Swiss.
That's great. That was perfect.
Thank you.
Wow. Wow, I don't have to book Jamie now.
No, it was good.
You have to overmodulate at some point, though, if you're going to do Jamie.
Oh, fuck you. So
you met them. Did you go see a show and meet them after the show?
No, it's actually they came and saw one of my shows.
I like that.
Oh, even better.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
you got to invite them backstage and sit around and chew the glass.
Yeah. No. So, yeah, and the great thing about it is shortly after I met them, we went out to the Meadowlands Fair.
Yeah.
And Ward Hall, the last of the old sideshow showmen, he's in his 80s now.
Yeah.
Had his show out there, and Ward has always been my hero. And that night even more so, because we're walking up to the show, and Ward's there, and he's on the outside, and he's talking, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, we occasionally are very honored to have special guests, come and visit us as we are doing our show around the country here. And there, it's always nice when friends come and visit, and especially when they are very well known. And that's why I'm so honored to introduce to you, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Todd Robbins. and Teller was standing right in front of me, and they thought, and they turned around like, who the fuck are you? Thank you, Ward. So anyway, we became friends, and then I actually did some creative work on Sin City Spectacular.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. It was a lot of fun. And so anyway, years later, I had done a show off Broadway called Carnival Knowledge.
Yeah.
And it was all about the sideshow, because that's sort of my background.
Yeah.
And thank you. It's been stolen by a couple of people.
Oh,
and
those bastards.
Yeah, yeah. Well, those you can kill. I'll give you
all right.
Yeah. So, would you quiet down over here? I'm trying to talk here.
We'll get Dave in there.
Okay.
We'll get Dave.
Don't worry. Once I get started, you're not going to be able to stop me. I can't seem to stop you right now.
Yeah,
so you just have fun.
That sounds like an extraordinary claim. So,
don't worry. I got some seriously extraordinary evidence.
Yeah. So anyway, I did the show, and it was fine. And then when that finished and we did a little tour of it and stuff, I was looking around for another project, and I decided to do a seance show.
Yeah.
And that's where this all came around, in the New York International Fringe Festival, and then we took it to Two River, and then the idea of doing it in New York, but we want to retool it. So Teller and I got together, and we looked at the show, and he said, let's take everything you've done and everything that we have done, yeah. Penn and Teller, and all that we're interested in, put it all to the side and take a fresh page and start anew. And,
right, right.
And so this is the very, very, very long answer to how the magic came about, because we came up with ideas and then figured out how to do them afterwards. So we would talk about imagery, and I would start telling stories, and you know, one time I said, you know, I used to throw parties in the Long Beach Municipal Cemetery, and Teller'd say, really, tell me about it. And I'd say, well, I used to do the Friday nights when the moon was full, and I didn't do this, and I'd finish, and he'd go, well, that's in the show. Write that down. That's perfect.
Yeah.
So I'd write it down and give it to him. He said, great. This is perfect. This is wonderful. Let me rewrite it.
It's close. I must say, your Jamie's a little better. But that is a very close Teller.
Ah, fuck you. So, actually, here, is that better?
There you go. There you go.
So,
Todd, let me ask you.
Yeah. So what happened was we would sit there, and we wanted to do something about Marjorie, the Boston medium. That
these are all real people in the show.
Yeah,
and we are, for the listener, we are unfolding the nature of the show. You will learn about the show as you listen.
In a thumbnail, it's an evening of true stories about real people, some good and some not so good, that are all dead, that all had a relationship with death during their life. Yeah. And during the course of telling stories about them, we use magic and special effects, so you get a sense that they're gone, but they're not far away, and that as their presence is felt in the stories, thus things happen to let you know that they're still around. And towards the end of the show, they come back to visit. And who said if the dead were to return, it would be a pleasant thing?
Yeah, it's like a little bit of a roller coaster ride, actually. You're in the audience, and things are happening to you that you're not expecting.
Within the first 5 minutes of the show, we turn out all the lights, including the exit signs, to really give you a sense of what being in the dark is like.
There are people working on the show in the background that you never see.
Which I never saw.
You never saw?
No, they kept them away from me. The little people.
You never see them.
From Mr. Roberts.
And you remember Silence of the Lambs when Clarice gets in that basement and he puts on those goggles?
Night visions.
Mm-hmm. These people are wearing those and the lights go out and shit happens to you.
Let's just put it that way.
It's all I'm going to tell you. And it is visceral. It's visceral to watch.
Yeah.
It was amazing how well it really translated to film. And towards the end of the run off Broadway, Teller brought in a bunch of cameras and wanted to document the show because we wanted to live on.
Yeah, he didn't really mean necessarily to be making a film. He just got...
No, this was just basically for educational and archival purposes so that we could kind of take a look at it and we wanted to do it again. And it turned out so well that he said, I'm going to actually make this into something.
Yeah. Last year, I believe, I was at TAM, and he said, Emery, I've got some footage. I can't figure out in Final Cut how to stack it up. And I said, I'm coming out to the house. I'll show you. So I went out, and I stacked it, and I made a four up of the images so that he could see all of the cameras, and he could watch it. And once we put it up there, it was the footage for Play Dead. And once we put it all up there, he and I together immediately saw that this had been shot well enough to make a movie out of. And I said, it was funny, he goes, you've been here for 4 or 5 hours. Let me pay you for your time. And I said, no, you can't afford that. And after he got the joke, I said, I would much rather give that time to you with the promise that you'll consider me as the possible editor for this project. And he said, I'm already considering that, and we'll talk. So I went on my way. He called a few months later, flew out to L.A., brought the script, stood in the living room, and gave me a one-man performance of that fucking show off script. It was really...
We should have had that on film.
Yeah, I know, right? It was and he'd stop and explain what's happening and really just indoctrinated me, and I was just hooked. I was absolutely hooked.
Yeah, it turned out, like I say, fairly well. So the end result was that has been made into a film which we've shown around, including a TAM.
Yeah. And has anyone here seen the film? Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
Nice.
Have you seen it yet?
Not yet.
All right, we'll get you to see it.
I want to.
Yeah. Well, as of November, you can see it live because we're playing in Los Angeles at,
yes.
at the Geffen Playhouse.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
At Geffen.
Is it still in New York? Nice.
No,
New York?
No, no, no. We closed it down like a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was a great experience. But getting back to the creative, we would come up with images. I mentioned Marjorie. The Boston medium, the woman in the 1920s who brought sort of sex into the seance room. And we wanted to do something about her, and we were trying to figure out, we had a couple ideas for things, and then Teller said, what if we had a table, a large table, and brought up 12 people from the audience to sit around the table. And we bring out this girl representing Marjorie. And she's in a kimono, and she takes it off, and she climbs under the table and lies down face up, completely nude. And we tie her spread eagle. And you reach into her vagina and birth a ghoul out of her vagina.
He said that.
He said that.
In straight face.
And I said, works for me.
And that's what I call Tuesday. Yeah.
And I said, okay, how do we do it?
Yeah.
And he went, I don't know. Let's call Johnny Thompson.
Johnny Thompson.
Nice. So we pick up the phone. Hi, Johnny. It's Teller. Table, people from the audience, naked girl, spread eagle, birth of ghoul out of vagina. And there's a pause. And then we hear Johnny go, well, there's 5 ways you can do that. And when we got the right guy, we have a show now. And yeah. So we just came up with all these just ideas of what we wanted to do. And that image, unfortunately, is not in the show, but yeah. Something very similar, you understand, it did end up in the show. And everything was worked. We worked here in New York, here in Las Vegas, doing, built some of the prototypes of the tricks and just did like a half an hour, 45-minute showcase that we did at the Rio. In one of the showrooms that had been closed down, and they gave us for a couple of weeks. So we just did that just to see if we had the tricks worked. And so that was proof of concept. And then we did another more elaborate version of it at the, it's Clarion now. It's where it used to be the Greek Isle. They had a small room there. We set it up and did everything, a fairly complete show, and brought in the sound designer at that time because we knew sound was going to be a very important element.
Right.
Our sound designer, Leon Rothenberg, just won the Tony Award for Best Sound on Broadway.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so we can't afford him. And and then then everything was built. They set an opening date rehearsal for New York. They raised the money, and we did the full workshop out of the Rio, and they have sort of this big building out back. And they ended up, we built the theater in New York, the stage and
right,
the seating,
right.
Inside this huge space.
Right, and what he means is when you've got people messing with you in the theater, when they go dark, it's four times or three times? How many
three
dark?
Times.
Three dark. Three times. And they're so dark, you figured out a way, and I've never asked Teller about this, I'm going to ask you about it.
Oh, yeah.
You're supposed to have an emergency exit light at all times.
Yes.
What?
You can buy anything in New York.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's great.
But now you're touring with it, and in L.A., yeah, you can buy that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's technically not allowed.
It is. The way it works out, and is most major cities have consulting firms that are made up of retired fire inspectors. And retired fire chiefs, and they know the code backwards and forwards, and they also have very good ties with the department.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So it works out that you hire them, you say, this is what we want to do, and they go, well, here's what you can do, here's what you can't do, and you try to go beyond compliance, and then they are the ones that sort of deliver that information to the people who are going to say yay or nay, and they say yay.
Yeah.
No.
You call them and said, we'd like to have no lights at all in the theater, and there was a pause, and he says, there's 5 ways we can do that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there is a emergency button that turns all the lights on.
Oh, good, okay.
There is a cue that I could give if there was any problem. They also had people in night vision, every time those lights went out.
Prepared and trained and ready.
Yeah. And so we had a whole thing that if anything went wrong, And we never had any problem. The worst thing we had was people reaching out in the dark and trying to fuck with us.
They fuck with you guys and each other, don't they?
Yeah.
When I was watching The Green...
we don't mind if they fuck with each other.
You want that.
And I mean...
Fuck.
Fuck. They're with... The final moment where I bring a guy up on stage and I do something with him on stage, and he's up on stage during the last dark room. What I didn't know, I found out from the stage manager, is that he and his date were going at it hot and heavy every time we turned the lights up.
That's so great.
So he was angry when I brought him up on stage that he didn't get, you know.
Yeah, he was headed somewhere.
And
you took it from him. Well, you know, we're so closely related to the bonobo. A lot of people don't know.
Well, the fact of the matter is, for that show, there was no happy ending for
him. That's correct. You know, as an
assistant... Sorry I walked on your punch.
No, it's all right.
As an assistant editor on this show, on the film, it was really, really great to see how the tricks worked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... No one else here.
Well, first of all, you have to understand, we're talking about Teller magic.
Yeah.
Teller, Johnny Thompson, yourself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. These are artists who are at the top of the feeding chain when it comes to this.
Yeah.
And people don't get to see in the back room of these kinds of things.
No.
And it is incredible.
And
I want to add this. Yeah. I want to add this. If you think you've got something figured out...
I was just about to say that.
Go.
You don't.
Yeah.
You don't, no.
Yeah,
you
have your head deep in your ass. You have no idea. They are so wonderfully simple and yet magically complex. You couldn't possibly get there without the massive amounts of training that these guys have.
And
I gave a backstage tour to Johnny Gunn, who is the number one builder in magic. He's an absolutely brilliant man and is well-versed and... He came up and said to me, he said, I enjoyed that show so much because I thought I would have to kind of sit back and, you know, kind of overlook the magic. And he said, you fried me. I have no idea.
He doesn't know how you did the tub, did he?
So
I didn't. And when he saw it, he went, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And he immediately went out and called Johnny Thompson and said,
you're a genius.
Fooled the hell out of me.
Yeah. Now, this sounds like I'm tooting my own horn. I'm not tooting my own horn when I say this. I am tooting the horn of the guys who did... the amazing work, and I'm going to word this carefully, in the post. Now, in post, when we ended up doing color correction, the shooting darkroom work is very, very difficult. And getting things, getting the experience in the dark that you're having, there are these lights flashing in front of your face really quickly, and it's just visceral and hits you to your core. And getting that experience to transfer to the screen was really difficult, and we had a magic digital guy, help us tweak things perfectly.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion. Yes. And he really helped us get the color just right, and because the camera didn't catch it perfectly.
No.
Right. It just can't. It's either that green thing or no light, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so we really worked hard on getting those done just right, and that's all I'll say on that with this payoff. Johnny Thompson came up and said, how did you film that so perfectly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Because what you're seeing is what people are experiencing. That was the
and he's been in the theater. Yeah, he knows what happened.
Sure.
He thought we were giving him exactly what was happening. And there was work being done to make that happen.
So it's a really great film. And the whole thing was an excellent experience on my part. I just enjoyed the whole thing.
Thank you. We're looking forward to, and I just came from Teller's place. We've sat down and spent many, many hours kind of going over what worked and things that were learned from the movie. Like, there were a couple of things that he sort of tweaked a little bit. I was like, can we change that around a little bit? Because it kind of worked better in the film. There were just things that we didn't know.
Sure.
And so we've tightened a few things up, and then...
Yeah, the film shows you... do you agree with that, too? I mean, how the film shows you... by compacting, you kind of can raise some of the elements.
And it's nice working with new sets of designers, and we're working
that you can afford.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, there were some things we wanted to do that we never got to, and there were some things that I went, you know, it would be nice to have done this. And Teller had those same thoughts.
Yeah.
And so now we're going back and adding all kinds of little things to it that just when we finished today, we're like, now everything makes sense, because there are a couple of things that...
Did you figure out how to nail your face?
What, nail my face?
Yeah. Blockhead.
Yeah, I understand that you've got some new
I was just
Provenza.
About to say the same thing.
Yeah, Provenza told me to ask you about...
The nail.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Son of a bitch. Did he think he was on the show?
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there's not a special nail that you use when you're...
Yeah.
No, it just goes back.
Mm. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
What? You know.
You never lose your glasses, though, do you?
Mm. Oh, that's delicious, isn't it?
Well, they slip off otherwise if you don't do that.
So many questions to ask you, but I wanted to ask you mainly about the light bulb.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you like doing that?
Sure. I love doing it.
You like chewing on that?
Yeah.
First of all, let's clear it up. He walks out on stage, and he presents a light bulb, which you've just seen him take out of a light socket. And he holds the light bulb up, says some lines, and then bites into it.
Yeah.
And my favorite part of this whole thing is when you share with the audience, the guy who came up to you after the show. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's there's no trickery to it. It's the one completely real thing in the show other than the stories that we're telling. There's no trickery to it, and people work very hard to be idiots. and a guy came up to me, a real mook, and he said, I like that trick. I'm like, well, okay, it's not a trick. Yeah. And I said, no, you really, the way you chew up the glass and swallow it so it doesn't cut up the mouth and throat, and there's a diet and regimen I go through every day that keeps the glass moving through my system. And I'm in Ripley's, believe it or not, for having eaten more than 4,000 light bulbs during the course of my career.
Well, it's the or not that kind of gets him in that state.
Yeah. And he went, yeah, you can't bullshit a bullshitter. And I felt sad for him. I really was like, what? Okay, yeah, I can't.
I just told you everything you need to know.
Yeah. And you're just working really hard to be an idiot. So I just shook his hand and said, I can't fool you.
Yeah.
And I stole his watch.
So. Yeah, that's... in your line.
And that's how I met Criss Angel. So, No.
I'm embarrassed. I didn't think of that joke.
No. I'm embarrassed. It was David Blaine. So,
You're an old carny, right? I mean, you go back.
Yeah.
You've learned how to rob people.
That's actually what I'm doing. I'm doing the carnival stuff tomorrow night. And... in the big Magic Mayhem and Jamie and Swiss show.
Right.
So
did Jamie call and ask you to do the show?
Yeah.
And how'd that go?
He said, we're doing this thing at TAM. You haven't been to TAM for a while. And I said, sure. It just worked out.
Good.
And, you know, I had the time free, and it's great. So I'm very happy to be here. And sitting in a dark room in the middle of Las Vegas here.
With a bunch of fantastic, interesting people.
Yeah, it's the strangest intervention I've ever been to.
We think you've been eating too much glass.
Well. Will you be here for the Penn Jillette Bacon and Donut Party?
Yeah, sure, of course.
You know that Heather plays in that band.
I'm in that band.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I did know that. But I hammer nails in my head, so
it's going to be a blast. Tons of bacon, tons of Krispy Kreme donuts,
tons of
Penn Jillette. Stupid rock and roll, and people are excited and can't wait.
It's the most fun you can have with your clothes on.
Except there's going to be strippers.
Well.
Now, while we are doing Skeptically Yours, that's the show, we generally don't get into atheistic discussions on this show. We save that for ardent atheists. But we have David Silverman sitting at the end of the table. At the head of the table.
Or the foot.
I think you may be the most ardent of the atheists I know, including myself.
I'm America's loudest heathen.
You are indeed. Now, American Atheist, the organization, you're the president.
Yep.
And
you drive a Tesla.
I don't want to forget that. You do drive a Tesla now.
I do.
I love what you said. Are you going to say publicly what you said to me privately about when you got that Tesla? I don't want to force you.
How I got that?
Yeah.
Basically, what happened was that within just a couple of years, both my parents died, leaving me money. The Reason Rally happened, and I got a book deal. And then I told my wife, I'm getting a girlfriend, or I'm getting a car. And being a married man of 23 years, I knew the answer to the whole, you know. But she said, okay. So I bought myself a midlife crisis car.
Oh, and, good for you.
As every midlife crisis car should be, it's red. And
Perfect.
And I love it very much. And it's cool because it's 100% electric, and I charge it off the solar panels at American Atheist's headquarters.
You have solar panels for the headquarters.
So
that's nice.
It's literally a green car. It's a solar-powered car.
It's a green-red car.
Yeah, it's a green-red
car. It's a green-red car.
Yes, I'm very happy with it. It's my new girlfriend.
Well, congratulations.
Actually, I think it's a boy, so I think I'm gay for my car.
I could see that.
I know you're gay for your car.
I'm pretty gay.
You
for
showed
my car.
Me the key.
Yeah, and pictures.
Yes.
That key is huge.
So tell us what's going on
with... It's not the size, it's what you do with it.
And one of the things that my car can do is it talks to my phone. My phone has limited controls over my cars. So while my wife was driving my car yesterday, I could tell she was driving my car.
Because it shows you.
Because it shows me on a map.
Nice.
And I opened the sunroof while she was driving the car from Las Vegas. And then she closed it, and then I opened it again. just to fuck with my wife. But we're still married.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, you keep that up. Yeah. You will get the girlfriend.
You think you're still married.
That's right. Yeah. You haven't been home yet.
How much control do you get from your iPhone on your... Can you careen her off the road?
Not yet. I'm working on that app.
Yeah.
But I can play with it, and it's something that I'm very, very happy with. It's you know, it's green, it's high tech, it's American, it's got all the features that I like in a car.
Yeah.
So I'm very pleased with it, but you didn't have me on here to talk about my car.
I had you on here. Specifically, I would like to talk about the monument that you, the American Atheists organization, erected in Florida. Last week?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, we erected the first ever atheist monument on public land.
Yes.
This is a permanent atheist monument on public land. And the nice part about it is it's there for, you know, some very specific reasons. There was a Ten Commandments big
monument.
Black erection on the public lawn already. And we sued. We said you have to take it out. And
you sued because it is clearly a violation of church and state.
And it was not one of those situations where it was surrounded by other documents.
Where was it?
Stark, Florida.
On the steps into the courthouse, right?
Yeah, you can imagine a C-shaped building, and you walk into the open area of this quad, and it's right there, and it's 12 feet tall. It's huge. It's a big thing. And
it's not the size of the monument so much.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
it's where you erect it.
It's where you erect it. And we sued, and
we think they're overcompensating for something.
Oh, are they not?
Yeah. Oh, they're definitely overcompensating for a complete lack of. But you know, anyways. So they, we told them they had to take it out, and they agreed. But then the Christian group who put in the Ten Commandments threatened to sue the city if they took it out. Now, you can sue anybody for anything, even if you're wrong. They would have sued and they would have lost, but it would have cost the city time and money. Mm. So the city said, frankly, the right thing for the city to have done in the situation was to say, all right, we're going to make it a free speech zone. Now, when they do that, they say two things. Number one, they say the atheist can put up a monument. And number two, they say if you don't put up a monument, we don't have to take the Ten Commandments down. And therefore, that legitimization that that religion gets from having the Ten Commandments on public lawn stays legally, and there's nothing you can do about it. Because a lot of people say, well, we shouldn't try to put up these monuments. We should try to take the Ten Commandments down. We all want that. We don't have that right. Okay? We cannot say take it down. We only have the right to demand equality and equal representation and not favoritism. The best way to do that, in my opinion, is to take the Ten Commandments out. But that's not the only way. The other way is to allow us in. And if they allow us in, even if we choose not to go in, it's legal, and there's nothing we can do to stop it.
Right.
How many people have spray painted it yet?
None. 2 weeks, vandalism.
How long do you think it'll be?
No, I don't think it's going to happen.
You don't?
I think it would have happened by now.
I'll bet you $100.
Yeah.
Honestly, if you want to place a wager.
Yeah.
I'll bet you $100 within 2 months it will be vandalized. And I don't think just spray paint, but I'll go with the minimum of spray paint.
I'm not going to take the bet because
son
I'm not
of a
sure.
Bitch.
I'm not
you drive
sure
a Tesla,
right.
You fucker. You can afford a $100 bet. What do you think? You really don't think? It sounds like you don't think they will.
I don't think it will.
How
I don't
come?
Think it'll happen because it hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
And because the thing is in a public court, a public courthouse, a public lawn, there's TV cameras there.
I swear you said public whorehouse, but you said public
court.
Where's your brain, Emery?
It's a, you know
with
where my
erections.
Brain is.
He likes to talk
right
about
below
the
your
big
tattoo.
Block erections, but that's beside the point. Now I lost my train of thought.
I really think they're going to tear at it.
They might, and I'm not going to say they definitely won't. Certainly the town is populated with people who have that mentality, but they haven't yet. And I would have thought that it would have happened. I mean, I would have thought that it would have happened the first night or the second night. But
right.
It's been 2 weeks now.
Yeah, it's too hot right now. The minute you have a homeless guy in that fucking thing, someone's going to...
Well, it is a bench.
Yeah.
It is a bench. We wanted to have function.
Yeah.
And we have announced...
Todd?
Well, I was just thinking as a carny.
Oh, this is going to be good.
Starting a church...
Mm-hmm.
Getting a really good lawyer.
Yeah.
Some really nasty slime ball.
You said lawyer.
Yeah. Copywriting the Ten Commandments.
Fuck off. This is such an idea.
And then suing wherever they're up without
insane.
For infringement of copyright.
Can they do that?
No,
I don't know.
You can't copyright.
Why not? Why can't you?
Because it's public domain. It's thousands
so
of years
So once
old.
Something becomes public domain...
You can't copyright it. That's,
right.
That's like copywriting Shakespeare again.
Well, unfortunately, we do not live in a libertarian world. That's not possible. Sorry, Todd.
Well, again, it gets back to his whole thing that it might not be possible, but... But that doesn't mean people can't sue.
That's true.
So if you started this up and said, you know, it's being misused, and we, as God has told us, that this is we have a right to do this.
Right.
Yeah.
That'd be a good fight. You know what I like about putting a monument up?
What?
As opposed to demanding they take it down.
Mm-hmm.
There is a libertarian streak in me, the freedom, the absolute freedom streak. You
mm-hmm.
know, drugs, sex, all of it should just fuck you. We'll decide.
We
got this.
Uh-huh.
I like the idea of, I don't want to restrict the speech of anybody, including the KKK or you. I think everybody should have the ability to express themselves, and this fits right in that wheelhouse, and I like that.
Well, and I don't totally disagree with you on that. I think the public courthouse should be free of this. I don't think the U.S. government has freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the U.S. government has freedom of religion.
Yeah.
I think it has the freedom to allow us freedom of religion.
Right.
And I think that every step away from freedom of religion... Every step away from the separation of church and state is a step away from freedom of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I see your point that adding a monument versus taking it down increases speech, and more speech is better than less speech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My personal opinion is that the government shouldn't be in this domain at all. The government shouldn't be about religion. The government should be about protecting our rights to be religious or non-religious as we see fit.
You and I could not agree more strongly on that. Sadly, mm-hmm. that's not where we're living.
Right.
You know what I mean?
No, that's exactly right. So if we have a situation where there's a Ten Commandments display on public lawn, American Atheist is going to be putting up to 50 more.
Yes.
Yay. That's the question I had for you.
Yeah.
I wanted to know. I said 500, not 50.
Well,
but 500's good enough.
It's a lot of money.
That's
a lot of fucking money.
It's a lot of money.
I wanted to know how you guys came up with what sayings were going to be put on.
Oh, we had a whole meeting about it. The nice thing about this is that the monument, I think the monument structure is going to stay the same. It's going to be a bench. Because we like the function of the monument as opposed to just the Ten Commandments, so you can look at it.
Mm.
But the sayings themselves can change, and we can make them on an individual basis.
Yeah.
So every time we do that, it's going to be another press hit,
right?
We want to make sure when we put these things up, we don't want to get to monument number 30 and it's exactly like 29, 28, 27.
Yeah.
There's nothing more to write about. So we're going to be changing these up and making them. More and more interesting, more and more newsworthy.
So you're doing it for the press.
Yes. Yes, so of course we're doing it for the
press deal.
Yes,
you got to tell them.
Of course, it's a press
deal.
The idea, what people have to realize is that the Christian organizations that put the Ten Commandments on public lawn, they do not do it to express themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we were talking about freedom of expression. This is not about freedom of expression for the Christian right. They'll say it is, but it's not. It's about legitimization that they get from having a monopoly on public land where no one else is.
Right.
When we go in there, you go to Stark right now. When you go to Stark a month ago, you saw Christian legitimization. Stark, Florida.
Yeah.
You saw the government endorsing Christianity.
Yeah.
And right now, you go to Stark, Florida, and you see the government specifically not endorsing Christianity.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's not what they want.
Right.
That's not why they're putting these up. They can put Ten Commandments monuments on any church and everywhere they want. They want it on public land because they want the perceived endorsement from the government.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't have the perceived endorsement, the sole monopoly endorsement from the government, they lose the value proposition that they're going for. Not the one they're saying they're going for. That's a lie. The one they're actually going for, which is completely negated by the presence of any other monuments of any other religious philosophies.
Right.
That's why we're doing this. That's why this is a press play. We want the Christian right of America to know that we have a very easy legal means to stop them from getting a monopoly representation on public land, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
Well, that's good. Thank you for doing that.
Yes.
I want to take us to... We're at TAM. This is a skeptics convention.
Yes.
And before I go there, question. Is it?
Yeah.
Todd, my first question to you on this topic is,
yes.
I don't know anything about your belief system. I have assumptions, but I don't want to assume. Do you consider yourself an atheist, agnostic, a believer of any sort?
No. I mean, why should anyone believe?
Thank you. I mean in God.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure where we all were coming from. As an atheist, when I started coming to TAM, there was a sense that I didn't quite belong in or fit in here because I'm an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And skeptics, I'll explain.
Okay.
Skeptics go, skeptic groups like TAM and others, they tend to go kind of out of their way to try to make sure that there's kind of a separation between atheism and skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for good reason, by the way. It took me a while to come to an understanding of that, but I think for reasonable goals. And I think that some atheists feel a little pushed away, a little shoved out as a result of that. I love seeing you at TAM. You're the atheist, really, and I love that you come here. Have you experienced what I'm talking about? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely know what you mean. And one of the things that I've mentioned to a few people is that attendees at TAM seem to fall into two categories: those who are members of American Atheists, and those who
are getting raped. I'm sorry. What?
And those who hate American Atheists.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really.
So, I mean, you've got a very strong dichotomy here. You've got people who are thrilled that I'm here and people who are not thrilled that I am here.
Yeah.
And they, because, look, skepticism is a means to, skepticism is a means to an end.
Yeah.
Okay? The end is atheism, frankly. Okay?
Yeah.
If you take skepticism, as far as I'm concerned, if you take skepticism, you apply it to religion, you get atheism. You don't get anything else. You don't get maybe. Okay? If you take skepticism and you apply it to Bigfoot, you don't get maybe.
Right.
You get no Bigfoot.
Well, there are many...
But Bigfoot
there
doesn't break all the known laws of physics in the universe, but God does.
Mm. Yeah.
And my representation here is that statement. It is saying, hey, skeptics, those of you who aren't atheists are not doing this correctly. If you're a skeptic and a theist, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
So I make that statement, and there are people who haven't taken that leap, who haven't gone to that step, who say, I don't believe in Bigfoot, I don't believe in aliens, I don't believe in homeopathy, but the invisible man in the sky is a maybe.
So you're saying there's skeptics 6 days a week?
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's good.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Very good.
Well, I have yet to actually meet a real theist in the skeptic world. Actually, I think there might be some.
There are.
They're not finding their way to me. Deists I've met.
We had a table here last year. We didn't table this year. We had a table last year, and people were. We had a few people come up to our table, and make impassioned pleas for skeptical theism. Skeptical theism, and they could not do it. You know, we would say, okay, tell us. Tell me why Bigfoot is a definite no. But the man in the sky is a maybe. Mm. And they'll say, well, I was raised, and this is what I believe.
Yes.
And you could see the skepticism shut the fuck down when they talk about religion. And it makes me feel bad.
You think it's a fear that's keeping them
that
way?
Yes, of course.
Well, now,
is.
What about the argument that really frustrates me, and I think is inaccurate, but I'm not smart, honestly, not smart enough to refute this one, and maybe one day I'll become older and wise, and figure out how to battle this one. But you can't prove a negative or disprove a negative. That whole line of thinking seems fundamentally flawed to me.
Of course, Russell's teapot. I mean, you can't prove that there's no teapot orbiting Jupiter, but there's no reason to actually think it. So why would you even live your life as if it were a likelihood or a possibility.
Yeah.
But a teapot orbiting Jupiter does not break all the laws of physics all the known laws of physics. So when you get to something that, well, you can't prove it's not right, you get into the concept of what exactly is knowledge.
Yeah.
What exactly do we know? Are we in this room taping this, or are we in the Matrix plugged in like the movie from Keanu Reeves and there's a plug in the back of our head making us dream this? Well, we can't prove that's not happening. We don't know it for sure.
Nothing.
But we don't know it for sure, but we don't live our lives as if it's a possibility that this is a dream. We live our lives given what we know to be true from our experience.
I would argue that a lot of people live their lives as if they're living a dream, and I'm not even trying to joke. I think a lot of people prefer to live in the self-delusion of belief in a lot of different ways. Someone in a shitty relationship does that.
And prefer to live in the self-delusion is the right way to put it.
Right.
A lot of people say, well, I choose to believe in a God. They don't choose to believe in a God. They choose to pretend to believe in a God. You cannot choose to believe. You believe what you believe.
Yeah.
You can't believe the world is flat because you want to.
Yeah.
You have to be convinced the world is flat, and then you will not be able to choose to believe something else.
Did you see Jamie Ian Swiss's, Todd, you might have as well, I'm not sure how much you follow Jamie, but he gave a speech along these lines about how skepticism isn't what people. There's kind of a he's arguing there's kind of a straw man game going with skepticism. He's saying it's skepticism and atheist activism, which is what you and I do.
Mm-hmm.
Not specifically what is going on within the skeptic community. And he also pointed out very, I think, eloquently and accurately that Randy himself and the JREF have done their part debunking bad religion.
They have.
You know what I'm saying?
Certainly James has.
Yeah,
certainly.
Absolutely. So there's. Did you see his speech on this?
No.
It got so much weird attention. It was really amazing how people reacted to it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fucking reasonable. I would recommend you check it out, by the way.
All right.
I'll link you up to it. I thought he was really right. Really right.
Well, skepticism is a process. Atheism is the lack of a belief in a God. And atheist activism is a process.
There you go. Atheist activism is the process
that we're
really talking about.
And when we're talking about atheism, we're just talking about self-identification.
Yeah.
Okay? And avoiding the self-identification, avoiding the dreaded A word, because, well, we want to please the people who don't like the A word, who are the people who are pushing us into the closet and keeping us down. It's very odd when people don't want to use the A word because they don't want to use the word atheist because they don't want to offend theists.
Right.
Well, how does that work out?
Well, do you do with a theist?
Well,
think it's a lazy thing? Like, I don't want to get into it, so I'm not calling myself an atheist.
I think that's
I think it's complex.
I think it's
all over the place.
I guess it could be lazy, but it's very frustrating to me when they go out of their way, even in a conversation with an atheist, yeah. to say that they're humanists and they're seculars and they're brights and they're this and they're that, but they're all atheists.
Right.
Everybody knows that an atheist, everybody here knows an atheist when they see it, is just an atheist. But when you're talking to somebody who doesn't understand it, so when you're talking to somebody who's bigoted, okay, bigotry comes from ignorance. Mm. And when you talk to somebody who doesn't know anything about atheism, who doesn't know any atheists, who doesn't think they know any atheists, you have an opportunity to educate. You have an opportunity to put a face to the word.
Did you just call me an idiot, Jew?
What?
Nothing. I was being a bigot.
But now that you bring it up.
You were going to say something, Todd.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's interesting. I'm not an activist whatsoever. It's just what I do. And
do you find some of the activist atheism that you're in the world, you see it?
Yeah.
Do you find it distasteful or bothersome?
No, because my feeling is that, and this is not in reference to the atheists and atheist activism, but I think people have a right to be as stupid as they want. and they're working very hard at it. And so, we have many people I know that are devoutly religious, and they play a limited role in my life because I just cannot have that. I just don't want that around.
Yeah, yeah.
But isn't there an ethical question here, though? I mean, if we're talking about progressing this country through bigotry, don't we as American citizens have the responsibility, at least to some extent, to try and squash that bigotry and try and make it better for our fellow human by coming out of the closet and using the A word when we have the opportunity?
Yes.
Many people were afraid, though.
But that's a good excuse 10 years ago.
Yeah.
There isn't a reason to be afraid anymore.
No, there really isn't. You know, I'm wearing a shirt right now that says "Proud to be an American Atheist." And you got a tattoo, an ardent atheist tattoo, beautiful tattoo, Heather.
Thank you.
Do you wear that visible in airports?
Oh, yeah. I did. And I was expecting to get some kind of trouble.
And did you?
No, not at all.
No, you don't. Okay, it used to be that I. That really hurt a lot.
That hurt a lot.
Do you think no one out there that is
people,
a danger?
Excuse me, there are people trying to sleep listening to this podcast. Stop doing
my apologies. You think that there's no danger at all out there for us?
No,
I mean, I
don't
American
think
Atheist. I don't know how long ago it was. Madeline O'Murray O'Hare.
Right.
Was
kidnapped and murdered, but not because of atheism.
Really?
Yeah, she was not kidnapped. She was kidnapped and murdered for money, not because of atheism.
Okay.
Okay? I have. I've gotten many threats. I have never actually had an attempt of violence. Yes. We have never had. Yeah, but it's been 10. It's been a long time.
She's just hitting on him.
No, but I mean, I've been an activist for 17 years now. Okay, and everybody knows where they can find me.
I'm with you on this. I really don't think we live in a dangerous world as atheists anymore.
Well, we have
not in this country.
Atheists have this terrible reputation, but Christians have a terrible reputation too, and they don't deserve their reputation.
Right.
I wear this shirt. I wear billboard T-shirts everywhere when I travel. Every airport in the Bible Belt. Every airport everywhere. I haven't been I haven't gotten any negative reaction in more than 2 years.
Well,
and I
more than 2 years, okay.
Yeah, but I travel a lot.
That's great.
Yeah. My mom experienced it reading it was Dawkins' book on a plane. She experienced some really awful behavior. But that's it. Not danger, not risk, just discomfort.
And you know what? That's what we have to do to bring this country forward.
Yeah. It's true. It's a conversation starter. I mean, the worst that I've gotten with my tattoo is, what does that mean? And I go, atheist means I don't believe in God. He goes, I know what atheist means. What is ardent? And so it's been, even at the store, the Apple store, you know, people are asking me, the salespeople are asking me what it means. It's pretty, starts conversation.
How come people are with a dent in it?
Yes, it is. It is.
How come people don't know that word? I'm really kind of surprised by that.
Well,
but I mean, I'm really a little tired of the I'm afraid to come out bit because I have been living as out as possible. I have been the in-your-face, billboard-wearing atheist for about 17 years, and it used to be negative all the time. I used to get lots and lots of negative response. None anymore. None. Zero.
And people are still afraid.
I think that's because they've sent out a pamphlet to everybody that goes, that Dave guy, he doesn't fucking care.
They're afraid.
It's not working.
But my point is that the bigotry that we perceive is out there isn't as strong as it is.
Yeah.
The hatred that we perceive is out there. We look at the polls, we say, oh, the atheists are least distrusted. Well, guess what? That's because we're not speaking up loud enough.
Right.
And that's because not enough people know atheists, but that does not imply there's a danger for being an outed atheist.
I'm glad to hear you say it. I agree with this. I really do. Yeah. All joking aside, and now you said it's been a few years. What do you think the turning point might have been, if there was one? Can you name any?
There was a big turning point at 9/11.
Yeah.
Okay, there was a big turning point at 9/11. Everybody was wearing flags, and that's when this shirt came out. This flag, I'm proud to be an American atheist, has an American flag on it.
Yeah.
That's when I started wearing this one, this specific shirt.
Yeah.
And that's when atheists started to come out of the closet
a
little bit.
Well, 9/11 made a lot of people question their belief system.
Yeah, and the George Bush era that followed, the W. Bush era that followed, really helped out.
Right.
And, of course, the explosion of the Internet is just
that's
going
how
to change
I became
everything.
An atheist through the Internet.
I mean, so, go ahead.
What do you want to plug, Todd?
Well, no, just very simply, I have a 5-year-old son. And that's not what I want to plug, but...
this is the second time we've had this conversation.
But my wife and I are both atheists. Uh-huh. Her family, her father was raised a German Catholic and all this, but...
Your son's a Jew, is that where this
well,
is going?
Well, no, he no. I could go for a joke, but let's just... And it's interesting, he's also an actor. He's on One Life to Live.
Whoa, so that's so great.
Yeah. That's one of my wife's soaps.
Okay, great. And it's been... And they retooled it, and it's on the air, and he plays the illegitimate... Is there any other kind? heir to the Buchanan fortune. But what was interesting, he went up for an audition for a Greg Kinnear movie.
Right.
And I don't remember the premise of the whole thing, but it's a guy who's... Greg Kinnear is a preacher who is doubting his faith, and then his son gets very sick and almost dies and comes back and talks about heaven and has this like little angel child, a Messiah child.
Right.
And so he was up for the role, and it was really difficult because he went, what's heaven? I go, okay, well, there's some people, and it's instead of saying, well, there, you know, God is up. I had to preface it as if it was a theatrical concept. It was a fantasy.
Nice.
And it was actually kind of good, but my wife was like, I don't know if he's going to be able to. And I said, oh, he'll be okay.
Have faith in your genes, baby.
And then it's very funny because he had to go in and sing Amazing Grace, and he just screwed it up. he just couldn't nail it.
I want to hear more.
That's not a problem.
What's his son's name is?
Phineas Taylor Robbins.
Phineas Taylor
named
Robbins.
After Barnum.
You have nice. You have more stories about Phineas, I presume. We're going to hear more about that after this. Well, we're going to do two things right now. You're listening to Skeptically Yours on skepticallyyours.net and available at the iTunes Store. And now, a special announcement. J.R. Swam is with us, in fact. Is that wrong? Yeah.
Actually, Michael Scott, Fulford, Eric Ingram, Paul Loeb, Brian Fields, Kathy Holzinger, Rainier Delgado, Stephen Vargo, Ed Ondrick, Brock Ross, Andrew Huber, and there's probably more people in here that
I didn't
get their
names. Who else is here we haven't said? Andrea Hogan's here.
Andrea Hogan's
here. Shout your names out. Paige is here. CJ.
Well, that's all the people that are in the room right now with us during this podcast at TAM 2013.
That's it for the free version of episode 46, another show that went off without a hitch.
We miss you, Hitch.
We'll be making the full 90 minutes available to our premium subscribers very soon. If you'd like to hear the full 90-minute show, please go to skepticallyyours.net/premium and subscribe. I want to thank our guests Dave Silverman and Todd Robbins.
Woo-hoo.
I also want to thank my co-host Heather Henderson. Tune in next week when our guests will be...
Hamsters.
And we'll be talking about...
Hamsters?
I don't know if that's... no, that doesn't make
our sense. Theme music courtesy of the sound editor of The Aristocrats, Eric Wilson, and special thanks to our Skeptic Tank moderator, Joseph Tam Virgin Swam, and our digital publicist and web guru, Cameron Tam Slut Winters.
You've been listening to Skeptically Yours on skepticallyyours.net. I'm your host, Emery Emery.
And I'm Heather Henderson.
And we are Skeptically Yours.
Skeptically Yours
is a product of an ever-expanding universe. Thanks, everybody.